Today, on this third Sunday of Lent, the lectionary offers up a magnificent gospel reading from the Gospel of John, the fourth chapter. Most of us have traveled these faithful waters most of our lives, so no doubt we have interacted with this moment in Jesus' ministry many times through sermons or Bible studies or our own devotions. It is Jesus' encounter with a woman at a well. In fact, before we read, I'd encourage you to take the Monday morning for just a moment and flip it open and just for a long pause, reflect on a beautiful mosaic I discovered this week, a 5th century Italian mosaic that offers a beautiful presentation of this moment. Such rich colors, such ancient arrangement. And then if you'd like to follow along, take a Bible and turn to John chapter 4. We'll share in this encounter together as we listen for a word from the Lord. We pick it up in verse 5. Verse 4, actually. Jesus, continuing his ministry, had to go through Samaria. And so, verse 5, he came to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that old Jacob, this is of course Jacob in the Old Testament, that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. And John says, it was about noon. Now we could pause there and note a few things that help us understand. First, Jesus had a roving ministry. Jesus never sat down and stayed in one place for too long. He understood his calling to be the arrival of God's fresh kingdom for all, and so his ministry took him all over Palestine. Here, it takes him to the border, to the edge of the geographical boundaries of his own faith people, the Jews. John makes that clear. We hear Samaria, and other than it sort of oddly sounding like a geographical locale, it doesn't mean so much to us. But as the story itself will note momentarily, Samaria was very much another place. It was very much on the other side of the tracks. It was a different ethnic and religious group. Some ties to Judaism. The fact that Jacob is remembered by the source of is itself an indication that there's some shared history, but by this point, by the first century, they were very much other. Jesus pauses at that well. The well, of course, in the Bible, not only a literal and physical place of nourishment and healing, it's hot in the Middle East, and so you need water, and that's how you got it. But I think more than that, across Scripture, wells seem to stand as a reminder of God's mercy, God's provision, for just as water nourishes the body, so water is a reminder that God has given the creation to support and supply us. And so, no wonder then that they attach Jacob's name to it, to remember old Jacob, a grandfather in this faith, one of the ones whom God worked through directly to seek and save. Jesus is there, and it's hot, and he's been moving, and so he rests. And John says, it was about noon. Verse 7. A Samaritan woman came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, would you give me something to drink? John notes that his disciples had gone to the city to buy food. But the Samaritan woman, taken aback, said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" You see, you get it now? She's no fool, this dear lady. Note, too, what John says parenthetically. Jews did not share things in common with Samaritans. That's so NRSV to say it that way. They did not share things in common. Makes it sound very antiseptic. They didn't like each other. Long before COVID-19, there have been lots of forms of social distancing. For all the beauty and grace sown into us by being made in the image of God, there is something about us as humans where we lean towards safety, we lean towards what we know, we tend to hang with the people who make us feel safe and same, and therefore sane. It's an old, old story. It goes right back to Genesis in the time of Jacob. And so this dear lady, by the way, do you notice we never get her name? This sister in this faith, she's nobody's fool. She gets it straight away. She gets it. She sees him resting at the well. She recognizes him as being from the other side of the tracks. And she says out loud what anyone would have been thinking. "How is it? Why is it? What are you doing asking me for a drink? This is not normal." Some would say this is not even right. Verse 10. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him," that is to say, you would have asked me, "and I would have given you living water." Now, what do you notice about Jesus' response? He doesn't answer her question, does he? She asks a very practical, real-world, everyday, common-sense, racially motivated question. Completely appropriate, given all the baggage between these two cultures and peoples. But Jesus responds, as he often does, by raising a different question. By turning the matter from the everyday ethnic, which we all bump into every day of our lives, to something larger. If Jesus was on Facebook Live or had a camera, it's as if he pans the camera out, right? Not the tight lens question of, is this appropriate? Can we do this? Can oil mix with water? Can apples meet oranges? That's a tight question. But already in this conversation, Jesus insists on backing the lens out, as it were, to get more of a panorama view, a broad sweep of what God's actually doing in the world. Isn't it good news, by the way, that God isn't tightly fixed on those questions anymore? If you knew who you were having a conversation with, dear sister, you'd be asking me for water. I don't think it's snark. I think it's just his beginning to reframe this whole conversation. Verse 11, I love this woman. She's practical. She's got work to do. She doesn't have time for a lot of chitty chat. So she says to him, "Sir, you have no bucket." I love that. Good for her. "I don't know what you're talking about with water. You don't have a bucket." Nobody's fool, she. Not only do you not have a bucket, this well is deep. She knows. She's out here every day. This is her Kroger. This is her Publix. She knows this spot. She knows what's at stake. "Where will you get this living water?" she asks. And then she raises the stakes. "Are you greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us this well and with his sons and his flocks drank from it. Nothing like calling Jesus out, right? Good for her. Good for her. She's made of some stuff, I suspect. She's not going to take it for granted where this conversation may be going. And based on what we're going to find out about her in a minute, good for her for clinging to the heritage of her people. It may be a thin thread. It may be a borderline thread. She may be out on the margins of Jewish faith and life. But by golly, she knows from whom she's come. Jacob gave us this well long, long time ago. Are you suggesting that you got something better than he does? Do you know something I don't know? Jesus in 13, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But those who drink of the water that I will give will never be thirsty. The water that I will give will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life. What a beautiful image that is. Now, we've just come through a rainy season. We can walk down at Emerson Park and still see the mud cakes on the ground where the river had been raised and has withdrawn, leaving a mess in its wake. So this might not be the right Sunday to talk about an abundance of water, because right now that's in the negative in our minds. But what a beautiful and glorious image Jesus invites her to feel and know. That amidst the dry ground, amidst the dry season, with God it's possible to experience a kind of well in the soul. An abundance of comfort and assurance, of knowing that one is loved and claimed and called. And the way that water wells up in our lives and sort of flows into every little nook and cranny. You know, that's really true of all of us, isn't it? Don't worry, I'm not going to make you give examples out loud, but do we not all have the broken pieces in our lives? Are we not all carrying with us parts of our stories that have become dry and brittle and have cracks in them, whether it be grief or loss or regret or frustration or anger? I mean, the world is not yet as God would have it be. So it seems to me we are all a little caked over. We all have within us pieces that are dry and brittle. So that image of a well coming up and that water spilling out in abundance, it's powerful. She's beginning to get it. Verse 15, she says to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water anymore." Now, around about verse 16, it gets interesting. Jesus says to her, "Go, call your husband and come back." Seems straightforward enough, particularly in a first century Semitic culture. But then John reports, "The woman answered Jesus, 'I have no husband.' Jesus says to her, 'You are correct in saying, I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true.'" It's a strange turn in this encounter. All of a sudden, we've gone from talking about wells and waters and God's grace bubbling up in our lives to the interior life and private matters of this still anonymous woman. Now, traditionally, preachers have assumed that Jesus' response to her is a kind of loving castigation or critique, as if to say, "You're right, and in fact, you're not even telling the full truth. In fact, you've had five husbands." At which point we all go, "Ooh," right? And then he adds what seems to be that little pinch at the end, "And the person you're with now is not even your husband." So one possibility is that Jesus is offering some loving rebuke, that her behavior is in question, right? And the number 5 plus 1 equaling 6 suggests something we sometimes assume about her lifestyle, about her choices. Is she living largely and loosely in the world? That has often been a preacher's interpretation. And it's possible that's what's going on. It's also possible, though, that when one takes seriously the first century world, when one considers that she is a woman, which would have had implications in that political and social context, and that she's a Samaritan, and that having to draw her own water, perhaps she's down lower on the rungs of the ladder of life. When you put all that together, it's quite possible that what Jesus is doing is not castigating or rebuking her, but actually, for the first time, someone sees her. What if Jesus is not critiquing her, but saying, "Listen, I see you. I understand your life. I understand that as a woman of little means, many of these are not your choices." You see, we kind of tend to look at things from a kind of middle-class American life. We can make our free choices, and we can kind of do this or do that, and no one's really going to get in our way. But it's not so in much of the world, right? I mean, many people find themselves in very complex and difficult and highly localized, camera-zoomed-in kind of situations where not everyone is a free agent. Not everyone is free to make lateral and horizontal choices. It is quite possible that her 5 husbands have not been of her choosing. That she has been, in effect, downstream of those choices. Maybe it's not critique, but comfort. I see you. I understand your situation. You're in your 6th go-round of being somebody else's choice. See the difference? Now, I don't know which it is. Is it castigation, loose living? Let's just say it out loud, we're all adults. Or is it comfort? You've lived a hard life at the hands of other people. Maybe, like most of us, it's some strange combination of the two, right? Because that's kind of how life is. We make our choices, but then we have to deal with others. And in my experience, life is overlapping and complex. The key point is that Jesus is at a well with a strange and other woman from a different faith family, and he is having a living, loving conversation with her across genders, across ethnic lines, across social status, across education. It's an encounter. And maybe for her, her first encounter that she's had in a long, long time. Which brings us to verse 19. The woman said to him, "Sir, I see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you say that the place where people must worship is in Jerusalem." She's catching on. She will not have a micro conversation about her own life. Now she takes his cue and, you see, backs the camera out and wants to have a larger question about, where is it that we worship God? Where is it that we know that God is with us and for us? How is it that we share in that interaction such that our lives are oriented and made right? Is it here? Is it in Jerusalem? What's the right answer? "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem." "You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation comes through the Jews. But the hour is coming," says Jesus, "and is here even now, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeks such as these to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." It doesn't matter that all of our ancestors helped build the downtown church. God doesn't live in that church. Jerusalem, the center of Jewish life for centuries and generations, and Jesus is saying, God's about to bust it open. It's not a poo-poo on Jerusalem. It's just a way of saying that it's not about the building, you see. It's about where we can worship God in body and in truth. I know that the Messiah is coming, she says. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to us. And Jesus said to her, I am he, the one who is speaking to you. Good for her. Good for her for hanging in there with Jesus and pushing back with her questions and drawing him out. Good for her for catching the cue that God is not just interested in the micro zoomed in questions of the heart, the right and the wrong. Those matter, but that God has a bigger picture for the world. So we can spend our time saying he's right, she's wrong, look how that person's living. Can you believe? We can do all that. Or we can catch a vision of spirit and truth and be the kind of church that worships wherever it is. It's powerful. Now we need to finish this up so I can get you home. Verse 27. Just then his disciples came. Look at this. They were astonished that he was speaking with a woman. Now, there it is, right? Social distancing. But no one dare say, what do you want? Or why are you speaking with her? And then, verse 28, the woman left her water jar and went back to the city. And she said to the people, come and see a man who told me everything I have ever done. He cannot be Messiah, can he? She leaves her water jug. It doesn't matter anymore. I mean, it does. You still got to eat and drink. We still have these bodies. But you see, with the camera panned out to see God's full face, it's no longer about this jug of water, that jug of water, what you've done, what you've not done, who's in, who's out, this side of the tracks, that side. Now it's about a vision of God who is worshipped in spirit and truth. And she goes running back to her people. And now instead of them talking about her, she has something to say to them. And she becomes, as a wise soul pointed out to me this week about this passage, she becomes the first evangelist in the Gospel of John. This is it right here. Not a fancy preacher with stoles and an MDiv and a diploma on the wall. A woman whose life has been encountered, who hung in there in a holy conversation and has now been reoriented vertically to the goodness of God. Come and see, she says. Come and see. And John says, left the city, and they were on their way to Jesus. May it be so in our own lives that we too would be encountered and widened, and in all of our living, worship God in spirit and in truth.